You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 328.
On today's show, we talk about the world's oldest quote-unquote structure, a Pompeian victim using a pot as a hat, and holes in a Peruvian mountainside used as an ancient accounting system.
Let's dig a little deeper, 5,000 times, because that's the only way we know how to count. Hello, welcome to the show.
Hello.
So, we're going to have some news items for you this week.
Yes.
And there's lots of stuff in the news.
There has been so many articles lately. In fact, I think I have I've pinned way more articles than we can actually talk about. So,
right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I actually thought we kind of had a little bit of a theme going, but when I started looking at articles, wasn't theming out. And you picked a different third article. So
I did.
Yeah. So no theme this week, but this first article does tie into a little bit about what we were talking about last week in the fact that, you know, humans and other species they interact with are really old.
Yes.
So, and the fact that those older species, you know, they weren't stupid. They were doing stuff.
They were
figuring things out. And that's what we're going to talk about.
Yep. Totally true.
All right. So this actually came from earth.com, which I honestly don't really know a whole lot about earth.com. We've seen them before, but
I know I don't either. And like totally randomly, that third article that I found is also earth.com. So that piqued my interest, and I didn't really research the publication itself very much, but I was like, where are they getting these articles from? Like, what is going on? And they're really well written. So first off, like really nicely written articles. And then they always link to the source article at the bottom, right? Mm-hmm. And I followed those for both of the ones we're going to talk about today. And this one in particular, this was published in Nature, the actual research was, and it came out in September of 2023. So this is like a 2.5-year-old article that it seems like they might be doing a little bit of like news recycling, like hunting for things to talk about, which again, I'm not mad about because we missed this when it came out 2.5 years ago. I do not remember seeing this or talking about it. So
I wouldn't remember 2.5 months ago, let alone 2.5 years ago. So
okay.
Who knows?
Fair point. But this is like, kind of, I don't know, it feels huge. So I feel like we would have seen it. So,
well, and the point is not really that this was published in a journal. The point is that it's being talked about being by talked news about. Media. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to see it. So we're going to talk about it.
There's a part of me that wonders if like with the other stuff we've seen about hominin research and the article we talked about last week and everything, if maybe this is bringing other research back into the eye of the media, which is great because it's just good to keep talking about this stuff. And even though it was published 2 years ago, it doesn't make it less valid or whatever. Yeah. It's just as interesting and just as important to talk about.
Yeah. Well, one other note too, and you know, somebody's probably going to beat me to this because I'm going to say it on a podcast that's listened to by tens of thousands of people, but earth.com, what a get.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Like, I know, right?
Like, I want to go get all the other planets and then maybe a lot of the like potentially habitable ones of Saturn. Because when we become a multi-planet species, I mean, these are going to go for some high dollars, if dollars even exist
like,
anymore.
Do you think that Venus.com still exists right now, though?
Oh, Venus is definitely taken.
Yeah. So is Mars.
So is Mars.
They're all gone. Like some all of them.
Listen, some of the outer worlds, like the Belters, you know?
And
the,
oh, my God. What was that show?
What was that show? Oh, Expanse.
Expanse.
That Expanse.
Was a good show.
That was a good show. I don't think we ever finished it.
Didn't we? No. Oh, my gosh.
No.
That was political. A good space show. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So anyway.
Yeah. Tangent.
Yeah.
Who's shocked?
Yeah. Maybe with time machines, we could have like, you know, things in the past.com as well that you wouldn't think of, you know.
Got it. Yeah. Yeah.
So. Okay. Stir. So the title of the article, which actually, truth be told, confused me until I was telling Rachel why it confused me.
Yes.
And then it didn't confuse me anymore because I had to say it out loud.
Yes.
But world's oldest wooden structure was built by an unknown species nearly 200,000 years before modern humans evolved. Now, right at the top of the article, they say a new study reports that early human ancestors built wooden structures nearly 476,000 years ago. And I was prepared to blast them for getting their dates wrong in the title.
Yeah.
But I just wasn't really paying attention. I read it too fast. I saw it's the 200,000.
A little bit of, it's one of those confusing news titles that, that weird language that they use.
I know. The crazy thing is they say 200,000 years before modern humans evolved. And then the article never really actually says when modern humans evolved.
Yeah, it doesn't talk about that at all.
We know it was 250,000 years ago, and some of our more savvy audience members do as well, because we talked about it last week.
Yes.
And I'm sure the Nature article mentions it, but they just didn't decide to mention that in this article.
Yeah, I thought I was a little frustrated about that, because that's the kind of stuff that immediately puts people off of learning stuff like this. If you don't already have that knowledge just in your brain ready to go, then it just makes the whole thing like a little bit more confusing. The who, the when, the where, the how, you know? So I would say, hey, journalists, let's do a little bit better job about setting the scene next time. So you include everybody who might be interested in an article like this.
Mm-hmm. This discovery was made at Columba Falls by researchers from the University of Liverpool and Aberystwyth University. It was led by Professor Larry Barnum from Liverpool. Mm-hmm. Now, the structures that they're talking about, I mean, not really structures.
Oh my gosh, structure is such a reach, right?
Yeah.
That's another like slight criticism I had.
The hominid worked wood that they're talking about predates the evolution of Homo sapiens by about 200,000 years.
Yeah.
So, and we're actually talking about an unknown hominin because there's no way to know who that is without them leaving their bones as well.
What are you telling me, that the person who built this didn't like collapse and die right next to it with the tool that he built it with in his hand, perfect, or her hand, perfectly preserved to show us who the constructor was?
Yes.
Dang.
That's what I'm telling
archaeology,
you.
Archaeology, you need to do better, because you know that's what we need.
As archaeologists, we just love labels, which is why I was advising somebody I know closely just the other day that if they're going to put a label on stuff that they create, don't use like a nickname no archaeologist is going to understand in 300 years.
Yes.
Like, you know,
listen,
help us out.
Listen, I can use a nickname if I want, because it's who I am.
Well, I'm just saying. Yeah, I want full name. I want social security number. I want date of birth.
Listen,
I want coordinates.
I'm just trying to keep future archaeologists employed, okay?
Yeah.
I'm worried about AI taking over the world, so I'm just trying to like keep the lab rats in work.
Okay.
Okay.
There we go. Well, the lab rats will be AI in 10 years.
Yeah, so, probably.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Anyway, excavations uncovered well-preserved wood due to the waterlogged conditions at the site, which, you know, most of the time we don't like water very much because it like destroys things. But water is also a really great preserver if it's not just water sometimes, but it's like waterlogged soils that aren't too acidic and it's got all these different conditions.
I think it has to be an anaerobic conditions, right? We need no oxygen so that decomposition can't occur, basically.
Yeah. It's like the bog bodies up in, you know, the UK.
And if I got any of those like science sounding words wrong, my bad. Feel free to call us out.
Right.
But I'm pulling that out of my memory bank.
Yes. Email us at Tristan at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com with any complaints.
So the artifacts that they found, the wood artifacts, included a wedge, a digging stick, and here comes the structure, a cut log, and a notched branch.
Well, that must be a building.
It's definitely a building.
Yep.
But in their defense, when you see the notch, and we definitely recommend going to the article that we've linked and looking at the pictures, you do distinctly see that notch and like use your brain to kind of envision Lincoln logs, you know, and the way they would have sort of stacked together, where you cut a notch into wood into one and then put it on top of the one below it to create a corner or a wall or whatever you're doing with it. So that's what they think they were doing.
I mean, listen, chimpanzees today can use tools.
Yeah.
Crows can use tools.
Right.
Right. They'll pick up a stick and wedge out something. Right.
Yep.
Like chimpanzees will use a tool to bash something. They've almost been seen almost like whittling or carving a little bit. Not really like with a knife, but you know, that sort of action.
Yep.
You give somebody just a little bit bigger brain, which the hominins had. I mean, it was a lot bigger than a chimpanzee, but functionally, you know, and the minute they start figuring out, hey, we can kind of shape this stuff ourselves because we have stone tools. We've had them for millions of years at this point, but we can carve stuff out. And the minute you start doing that, you start realizing, well, I can probably build some kind of a shelter or I can, you know, whatever the case may be, I can start doing stuff like that. And none of that, in most cases, is going to be saved or preserved in the archaeological record.
Yeah. I mean, that stuff just decomposes in almost every environment. So, you know, it's great that these finds are indicating that there's more advanced woodworking than we previously thought by these early humans in this time period. But it's a no duh for me a little bit, because like, why, if they had these larger brains and they were capable of thinking more critically, they did make stone tools back then. Why wouldn't they have thought to figure out how to put wood together and do things with it other than maybe whatever a simple thing is that an ape can do, you know?
Yeah, most of our knowledge of early humans comes from stone tools and the bones that they left behind and the animals that they may have hunted with those stone tools if they're found in association.
If they're fossilized, right? Because then we have them in the record.
But there is so much about what they were possibly wearing mm-hmm. and what they were possibly, other things they were doing to their environment, like the woodworking and mm-hmm. things like that. We literally know nothing about any of that for millions of years of pre-human evolution. And it's just unfortunate. And we're trying to paint this huge picture of how people lived on this landscape. And we're kind of just grasping at straws here.
It's that missing majority concept that we've mm-hmm. talked about before. All of these organic artifacts, they decompose away and then you don't have them to add to the picture. And you do want to kind of assume that they were there in some way, shape or form, but you can't go too far in your assumptions because then that goes into the land of wonder, where you're just making things up and you can't be fantastical about it either. So, yeah.
Right.
So we do have some evidence of wood use. It's not like this is completely brand new, but those were limited to just simple tools like spears, digging sticks, things like that. Things that you can see chimps and modern apes using today. So, what you would expect to see from a pre-human species.
Yeah.
Pre-modern human.
Right. Researchers proposed that the builders, given their location and time frame, could have been Homo heidelbergensis, mm-hmm. which we've talked about before. They were sort of a precursor to Neanderthals. Mm-hmm. But this discovery nonetheless challenges the assumptions that we've had about the cognitive abilities of early humans, right?
Yeah, for sure.
But to be honest, 500,000 years ago, I mean, the brains of the species that we have found were not that much smaller and functionally probably very similar to what we have today. It's just, mm-hmm. like they said, the cognitive abilities, their ability to reason and look at the world around them and build something brand new that they've never seen before, right? That's uniquely human almost.
Mm-hmm, for sure. Now, you might be wondering how in the world could they date something that is 400 and some odd years old? Mm-hmm. And that they used a process called luminescence dating to determine the age of the wood. And interestingly, too, there were early excavations in the 1960s, I believe at the same site or at least somewhere nearby that also found wood in a similar context, but they just were not able to date it accurately because dating technology had to catch up, mm-hmm. essentially. So that's cool.
Yeah, that was at this site, actually, and maybe around it. But mm-hmm. that's the interesting thing, too, about some of the newer dating techniques is we really have to rely on the preservation skills of the researchers before us because... Yep. Literal textbooks have been written on that stuff and we still don't know a whole lot about it. But if we go back and reanalyze some of these collections, mm-hmm. like we've talked about lots of times, man, the things we can learn without even digging again.
Yeah.
Just the stuff that we currently have.
Yeah, totally. It's
we have to be aware of the potential complications of bad preservation or mm-hmm. just uneducated preservation because they weren't educated of future things that could happen.
I mean, contamination is real. So you really have to be sure that you have protected against that and you have to just trust that the past scientists did do that. So, yeah. But mm-hmm. if you get way out of sync results, you also kind of need to rethink that. I think in this case, they were able to date a bunch of pieces. So they feel pretty confident about their dating in this case.
Some of the cognitive abilities that this implies just by literally having a notch that another piece of wood could fit into, mm-hmm. it really does speak a lot to the things that they could do, like the ability to plan a project because you're mm-hmm. like, okay, well, I know what this thing is. I want it to look like. I'm going to put this little notch right here and then selecting the appropriate materials because certain woods would have been either easier to work with or just better for what they were doing. Mm-hmm. And you would quickly figure that out.
Oh yeah. So quickly. Yep.
Yeah. That would be kind of a no brainer.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny. I saw this when I was looking at archaeology articles. There was one that filtered in on the Apple News filter. That was somebody looking at all the archaeology or caveman related Far Side comics over the last 30 years.
There was
10 of them. Yeah. And one of them was this group of people standing around with full sized animals over their shoulders. And this guy standing in front with a stone knife in his hand going, uh-huh. with this stone knife, we can just wear the skins of the animals we kill. They literally had full-size animals over their shoulders.
Just like draping a bear over their shoulders. Cool.
But you got to think about stuff like that. Like how did these people cover themselves as they started losing fur, being naked on the landscape? How did they cover themselves before they realized how to skin animals?
Oh my gosh. The evolution of clothing and textiles is fascinating to me because it's like, it's not just fashion. It's survival too, right? Yeah. I love that.
It's almost kind of funny, the mindset too. It's like you know, you see you're getting cold. You're like, okay, well, great. I evolved. But what that did is I lost all my hair, right? So my family has hair. I have no hair. Mm-hmm. Didn't happen that quick. But the funny thing is, how does this person reason with the world around them, right? And right. they're like, well, the animals are warm. If I just wear their skin,
yeah.
will I be warm? Right. Turns out I will be.
Yeah. I love it.
So anyway. All right. So other things that they learned was how to fit these pieces together, planning and construction, and just all those sorts of deals that, you know, you don't really think about. I would almost argue that the ability to find the material and create stone tools was also was evidence of this cognitive ability.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know,
it's just another facet of it, which means that their brains were more complicated than we thought. And, you know, this discovery challenges the idea of simple progression from primitive to advanced, right? Yeah. Like they were doing multiple things at once. And so that's much more complicated.
It does make me think though, like we put stone tools on such a high pedestal because they're the only things we have evidence of going back certain distances like this. But the reality is, I mean, I could probably go and create a shelter right now in the forest behind us, mm-hmm. but I'd be hard pressed to make myself a stone tool. It's hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard.
Mm-hmm.
So I would almost argue that if we have evidence of a hominin or a society or something making stone tools, we can almost guarantee they were doing other stuff.
They were doing other things too.
Yeah.
Other stuff is easier.
Yeah.
What I also liked about this article is that it took a whole section to question the usefulness of the term Stone Age.
Yeah.
Because it does truly overlook
really the tool age.
Yeah, exactly. The building age or something. Because maybe not building, because what they were doing was pretty rudimentary.
Right.
But it is important to use the right word so that you are conveying the appropriate context. And Stone Age might not be the appropriate word anymore. I don't really know what to replace it with. Mm-hmm. I'm not making any suggestions. But just because it's what we find doesn't mean it was the predominant material that they were using.
Yeah. Overall, they probably used quite a few things that we just simply don't have evidence of anymore, like we said.
Yeah.
You know, all this stuff that decays, or they built things that we also don't have evidence of anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Makes me wonder if they should start, like researchers should start focusing in these kind of environments where you will have better preservation of organic materials so that we can start filling in the organic material piece of history better.
Yeah.
But also it's so hard because you don't know where you're going to find things. So it's kind of like shots in the dark a little bit too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, next, speaking of human inventions and things people do on the other side of the break, we're going to find out how a bowl made out of ceramic material cannot protect you from a volcano. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to episode 328 of The Archaeology Show. And this next article is about Pompeii. And I feel like Pompeii is a lot of like Stonehenge. Like you're just guaranteed to have some kind of an
article. There's always going to be something, especially as we go into like the warmer months. I feel like there's constant like press releases and things coming out of these areas that have so much rich archaeological history.
Yeah, for sure. All right. So this one, and it's a little bit different than I expected it was going to be. But anyway, it's called This Man Fled Pompeii as Mount Vesuvius Erupted. Archaeologists found him 2,000 years later, holding a bowl to protect his head and a lamp to light his way. So
that's like a really long title for an article.
Yes, it is. So the article just talks about the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in 79 CE that destroyed Pompeii. It was witnessed and recorded by Pliny the Younger from across the Bay of Naples. So we actually know quite a bit about it.
Yeah.
And not to mention all the things that have been found.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he wrote really descriptive descriptions.
Good job.
I'm good at talking. Of people protecting their heads with pillows and using torches in darkness when you wouldn't expect darkness. Like, you know, as the sun was rising, it's still so dark. So, yeah.
Yeah. And archaeologists recently found two skeletons outside of Pompeii's city walls, and they appear to have to confirm details from Pliny's written account.
Yeah.
One of the victims is a man in his mid-30s. He likely died early from falling ash. And the second, a younger man, 18 to 20, likely died later from pyroclastic flows. So they were having a bad day.
Yeah, they were. I mean, at this point, everybody clearly knows they're outside of the walls, right? So so they're not inside having died immediately. Mm-hmm. They're trying to get away. So that's like the point in the eruption. And they know that things are bad and they're trying to get out.
Yeah, the older man was found near a terracotta bowl that was possibly used to shield his head. He was also carrying a small oil lamp, likely to see through the darkness because the volcano would have practically blotted out the sun.
Yeah.
I'm actually not sure what time of day this was. They always depict it in daytime, but I think it was very dark because of the ash in the air.
Pliny the Younger, when he was writing, was watching from overnight times into the morning.
Yeah.
So in the morning when it was daytime, people are still using lamps. So that's the time period we're talking about.
Yeah.
So these skeletons were found near the Porta Stabia outside of the southern gates. And like we said, they were both likely attempting to flee toward the coast to get away.
Now, real quick, the Porta Stabia, as it says in the article, is a necropolis. And I actually read it as Porta Stabia first. I'm like, oh, were all the people buried here stabbed?
Yeah. Where's your Latin training?
Come on. Right?
Yeah. So the younger man may have tried to escape during a temporary lull in the eruption. And obviously that lull didn't last long enough for him to fully get away. And then he died. They don't actually really say too much more about him, just that he was killed or swept away by a pyroclastic flow.
Yeah.
The older man is the one that they wrote this whole narrative about for the title. He was found curled up with his right arm raised over his head, holding the bowl. And then there was a small oil lamp. It looks just like the genie's lamp in Aladdin, like that kind of shape.
Yeah.
And that was found near his left hand. And honestly, this is another one where you just have to hit the link, go see the photos, because they have a picture at the very top, which shows you can just see how he like, it looks like he almost sank down to the ground on his knees. The bowl still over his head and just slumped over and died like that. Yeah. It's so crazy. Probably the oil lamp fell out of his hand at some point because he couldn't hold it in place anymore. But the bowl stayed relatively near where it would have been over the top of his head.
Yeah.
It's just like so human and emotional and sad and tragic, but like really freaking cool at the same time to like find remains in situ like this.
Yeah. He was also carrying 10 bronze coins and wore an iron ring on his toe. And, you know, researchers thought that he just chose items for survival as he is busting out of wherever he came from. You know, money, light, protection, you know, something like
Grab what you can and go. You don't have time to get, you know, the paintings off the wall or tapestries or whatever else is worth money in your house. You just got to get the things that are portable, you know.
Now, all of what we just said was the first, like, quarter of the article.
Yes.
The rest of it was about the photo they made out of AI reconstruction.
It is. And yes, I have thoughts.
Well, yeah. And
yeah,
so does the people writing the article here, right?
Yeah.
So
again, go look at the article. You need to see this photo so that you can understand what we're about to discuss. But
right. So just to describe the photo a little bit too, you've got the man running with this pot over his head. We don't see the oil lamp.
No, I don't know why they didn't include that in the image.
I don't know. There's other people fleeing around. You can see the buildings. You can see fire. You can see a lot of like rubble and destruction already. And you can see Mount Vesuvius erupting in the background. And they used several, what I thought was cool is they didn't just pop this into ChatGPT and say, hey, make us a picture out of this. They used a number of AI tools to create different aspects of this photo and then brought it all together basically with Photoshop, which I thought was kind of neat. Because certain AI tools are better at things than others, right? So it just depends on what you want to use. But anyway, they used this to create this digital reconstruction of what would presumably be this guy's final moments. And the real argument here is, should they do that, right? Because what they said in the article was, you know, there's researchers and people who do this for a living that just like walk around places like Pompeii and they can see the two-story buildings because there are no two-story buildings anymore. They can see the two-story buildings. They can see the streets. They can see the people. They can see all the stuff because they've studied it so much. It's just in their mind's eye when they look at these things, they see that. And to an extent, we've been able to do the same thing too when we research things that we know very well. You know, we get onto a particular archaeology site and you can kind of just imagine what was going on around you.
It's kind of the fun of archaeology doing that, honestly.
Yeah, but people aren't trained in that generally, right? So it's not very accessible to most people. So what they're saying is, A, this can help make it accessible to most people, but also now you're putting a fine point on it and saying, this is what it looked like. And some people are going to be like, oh, that must be exactly what it looked like. And not thinking this is a possible scenario reconstruction, right? Because we have no idea what this looked like. We can guess, we can make an educated guess, but you know, there's some people that are being very pedantic about it and saying, oh, Well, what if it didn't look exactly like this? What kind of message are we sending?
I agree to a point. I think it's really nice to create something that visually is interesting so that people, again, bring people in so that they can visualize if that's not their strong suit. If doing that visualization isn't something they can just do on their own. But mm-hmm. I'm also like, this looks like an AI image. You know, it just, it has that overly polished, too perfect look to it. And it somehow for me, that like takes away from what would have been the actual experience of the people going through this. Now, I don't know how to do it better because AI is what it is.
Yeah.
But for me, I think that's what I don't like about it, is that it just seems like a too perfect version of what happened, if mm-hmm. that makes sense.
Yeah.
So, and like, also, there are a lot of people out there who do actual reconstructions from actual skulls and bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And I am wondering, like, if this is going to replace that really amazing work that they do, where you do get a facial reconstruction of the skull of somebody that takes so much effort and skill to create.
Yeah.
And this is just like tossing some stuff into AI. Yeah, of course. I mean, they fine-tuned it or whatever, but like, it, that's a skill set to do a facial reconstruction. Yeah. And you should not look at this man and think that it is a reconstruction of that skull. It right. is not.
No.
They had no information about hair color, eye color, skin color, hair length, any of it. They had none of that.
No, it's more likely they just popped in a description of somebody who would have lived in yeah. this time period during that time. Yeah, yeah. It's not a reconstruction. It's no, a it's scene gone. Reconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So anyway, interested to see what your thoughts are on this. If you have any thoughts like on this, leave comments.
Where does AI fit yeah. into the future? Is recreating, you know, scenes from the past using AI, is it a good idea? Is it a bad idea?
I mean,
can it go off the rails too quickly? Yeah. You know,
personally, I like it because museums have been doing this for 100 years, right?
They do.
They've
That's
been
true.
Doing their yeah. own little scene reconstructions and things mm-hmm. like that.
And
so
I do kind of love a reconstruction in a museum.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I'm like on the fence about it.
Yeah.
I just want them to be good ones and not ones that portray incorrect information
right.
because that's the danger, right?
Right. All right. Well, that's all the time we have for that one. On the other side of the break, we're going to talk about how some ancient Peruvians, or maybe Incas, people before that, built a calculator on the mm-hmm. side of a mountain. So back in a minute. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 328. So this next article, first off, also from earth.com.
Yeah, this is what yeah. we were talking about at the beginning, like totally yeah. did this by accident. I found this one. You had found the other article.
Yeah.
And similar to the first one, this article is covering research that was actually published last fall. So only 6 months old in this case, but still.
Weird.
Yeah.
They're clickbaiting. But maybe. It's getting us to click on it.
I am totally okay with this version of clickbait because they're not regurgitating somebody else's story. They just went and found articles that didn't get a lot of coverage and yeah. are covering them. And I love that.
I think instead you should just go to the Archaeology Podcast Network's new blog. And a lot of our episodes are being sort of converted into blog form. So if mm-hmm. you like reading about stuff, go check it out. Yeah, it's right yeah, over there. Sure. You can find it up under one of the navigation headers. I don't remember where they put it, mm-hmm. but it's there.
Yeah. And I feel like most of our shows do a really good job of covering like up-to-date stuff, topics.
Yeah.
They're, you know, they interview people who are currently working on things, and like all the different shows are very topical and current.
Yes.
Which is great.
Speaking of current, we're recording this just so you guys understand a little peek behind the curtains. We're recording this on the day that it's coming out.
Yeah.
Which is know. May the 4th be with you.
Oh, yeah. May the 4th be with you. Right. I always forget about that.
So,
oh yeah, we were supposed to be having a Star Wars marathon. Too bad work is getting in the way of that right now.
I may have had episode one playing on my Oculus, one of my screens, when I was working earlier
episode
today.
Episode one,
so.
AKA the worst of Phantom all Menace. Yeah. Nine movies.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean,
get that one out of the way and then okay. we can move on.
Anyway, I do like the OGs. Those are probably my favorite, but.
Oh yeah, obviously.
Yeah.
They would be everybody's I know. Favorite.
Anyway, point
yes.
is,
yes.
I was only on. Mentioning the day that we're recording this, because if you are listening to this week, May the 4th, 2026,
mm-hmm.
on Friday, Ash, who is a host of the And My Trial podcast
mm-hmm.
and a co-host of that podcast, her and I are. We've done this like once before, and then she did one kind of by herself, but
mm-hmm.
we didn't have a good recording of it. But if you're on our Discord channel, and you can find that at arcpodnet.com, and you can also find it at our Instagram at arcpodnet. But if you get onto our Discord, we're going to be doing a live playthrough. We're just kind of doing this. It's probably going to take a year for us to get through this whole thing, but there's a stupid game on PlayStation called Carbon 14 Dating. And we're going to be doing the next segment of that. And she's basically playing the game and we're talking about it as we go through as two archaeologists. It is archaeology focused somewhat, but also kind of a dating game. It's really dumb. But if you're interested in that, we're going to be promoting it this week on our socials. And then you'll see the times and you can either join in or you can watch it on YouTube after we're done. All right. So back to this article. The title is Study Suggests These 5,200 Holes Dug Into a Mountain Were Some Form of Ancient Accounting. And boy, do I have a lot to say about this. But let's talk about where it is and what it is first.
Yeah. And like I said, I found this article because it's Peru. And like anytime I see Peru in the news, I'm like, yes. Whoa, what's going on down there? I know things about Peru.
Peru or textiles, you can guarantee.
I don't know if
you
knew this, but I worked in Peru.
This, for new listeners to the show, it's like when somebody went to Harvard.
I know.
Like they never shut up about going to Harvard.
Listen, it was what made me fall in love with archaeology. I have so much nostalgia for Peru.
Yes.
But okay, so this is nowhere near where I worked. So we'll just throw that out there. Mm-hmm. But it's, the site is on a mountain called Monte Sierpe in southern Peru, and it features over 5,000 aligned pits stretching nearly a mile along a hillside.
Yeah.
And Monte Sierpe sits in the Pisco Valley, which is part of Peru's arid Pacific Coast Desert, which is very similar to where I worked because I also worked in the coastal desert, but I was way in the north of the country, and this is south, like south of Lima. And in this area, there's not a lot of fertile land. It's really only where the rivers are and they create these like narrow green areas. But otherwise, it's a very arid, very deserty area.
Yeah.
But people still live there. And it was an important place for like the meeting between coastal peoples and mountain peoples coming together too.
Potentially.
Yeah.
It would have been a good place for that, I think the article says, because of its proximity to both.
Yes. And we do have evidence of that in many places of that happening. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, the formation is called the Band of Holes. That's what they've called it because it's a band of holes.
It is a band of holes.
Yeah, they're all banded together.
It looks like a band. Like it almost reminds me of like, think of like a rhinestone piece of jewelry with the rhinestones out of it and the way like the little holes for all the, they interlock together. It like looks like that across the hill. It's just crazy looking. Well, I've never heard of this either. Had you heard of this?
I have not heard of this.
I love finding articles where there are, that are covering sites that we've never heard of. So that's another cool one, cool thing too.
So this most current study that this is based on proposes that the site functioned first as an open air market, then later as an accounting system under Inca rule.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They used drone mapping and microbotanical analysis to study these pits.
Mm-hmm.
And evidence suggests that the pits initially supported the trade and exchange among local groups. And the reason they're getting that information is because each one of the pits, there's a dominating, you know, material or plant or whatever that was put inside of it.
Mm-hmm.
So thinking that was intentional and they didn't grow here naturally, they weren't like blown in by the wind, that would be a random distribution.
Mm-hmm.
But it seemed pretty obvious that things were put into these pits on purpose by people.
Yeah.
Yeah. That I agree with.
Yeah. And like, if you have one type of one plant in a pit, then something they could have been doing. And if all the pits are roughly the same size, which it seems like they are about, they're about 6.5 feet wide, 3.3 feet deep. So like, and they're very square-ish looking too. So very similar. If you've ever seen a prospect pit in the Southwest, I feel like they kind of look like that a little bit, you know?
Most people probably haven't seen a prospect pit.
No, I guess
pit.
They probably haven't unless you go bumming around in the desert. But yeah, that's what they reminded me of in that picture. But yeah, so like if they're all the pits are roughly the same size and they only have one type of seed or plant in the bottom of it, then like maybe they were using that to measure how much of something was, you know, being traded or put somewhere or whatever.
Okay. So we've got two different uses of this though, and we really shouldn't confuse them because the first use they say was as sort of an open air market type of thing, which all markets were open air back then. So anyway,
well, yeah.
And they would put stuff in there. I don't know if it was for counting or measuring, but I think it was, I almost look at it more like a farmer's market booth.
It could have been just the pits were a way to organize the plants.
Yeah.
Not the plants, the goods in an organized way. So each pit, and then when they're selling things too, if it's part of a market, then they would know how much was in that pit. And like Joe Farmer could come up and be like, well, I need, you know, a whole bunch of this type of reed from the coast because it doesn't grow where I live up in the mountains. Mm-hmm. And he like pointed at that pit and say, how much is one pit's worth? How much does that cost?
I mean, that's a lot, you know? With no way to transport it or I guess they could have.
We don't need to look into the logistics of it. Maybe he's a representative of an entire community who's coming to do this, you know?
Possibly.
Or it may be they're sold in half pits or quarter pits, you know? It's just.
But we're still, the article actually says that early open air market, later possibly Inca accounting system where things were deposited in certain quantities and you could mm-hmm. have different quantities per pit. I would really be surprised if in the earlier versions of this, they were actually concerned with quantities or how much was in a pit. I feel like it was a stand and it was something they wouldn't have to build every year. They could literally just throw their stuff in it.
But why put it in a pit if they don't need to know how much is in there?
To keep it organized for, like I said, that farmer's market booth type of
experience. And why are they all the same size then?
Well, and see, herein lies the problem with this whole thing, right? Whether it was used as some sort of Inca, and they say Inca accounting system because as the Inca sort of took over the area and their imperial rule got larger and just mm-hmm. got more structured, like all ruling classes do, that it could have been a large accounting system, right?
Okay.
But they took this over at some point after it was already created and they could have added to it. But my problem with this whole thing is there's 5,000 pits.
Uh-huh.
Why so many?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. Why are there so many?
Yeah.
And why aren't they anywhere else? Those are definitely valid questions. There could have been other ones that were destroyed, you know, just because it's not there anymore doesn't mean it wasn't there at one point. So there's that.
And there could have been more than 5,000. That's even more concerning.
Well, not even that, but they could have been in other places.
Oh, I see.
But
I see.
Now they're gone. They've been destroyed. Right. Whatever. And so the site runs about 0.9 miles along this ridge
mm-hmm.
and the pits are arranged in group sections that are separated by walkways, which you can see in the images in the article. It's another cool one to go take a look at. But yes, 5,000 pits sounds like a lot, but if you have a bunch of different people coming, let's just set the Inca thing aside for a minute. We'll come back to that. But and we do know these predate the Inca because they are the earliest dates, I think, are in like the 1300s. So before the Inca were in this area. So let's just say that these are a bunch of different communities from coastal areas, from the mountains. They all come together and they have this market once a year, twice a year, whatever it is. And each of those communities maybe has its own. I'm making all this up. This is just like hypothesis on how it could mm-hmm. have been used. But maybe each community had this their own little pit area. And then people would be able to walk between the different ones. And maybe each pit represented a different grain or a cluster of four was a grain. And then another one was whatever, you know,
exactly what I was saying in the farmer's market scenario.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I get it. But the thing that those pits also did is let you know exactly how much you had and how much you had sold. Right.
Or they were just bins.
They could have been.
It would be difficult to measure quantity in a giant pit.
No, but it gives you an idea. Like if you're like, okay, in order to buy whatever I need to buy from these other communities, we need to sell this much grain and that much grain takes up four of these pits. So once we've done that, we know we'll have made enough money that we can go buy whatever else it is that we need from these other communities. Something like that, you know,
maybe
just a hypothesis.
Yeah.
And it might not have been used. So the Incas might have used them more specifically, but that's how I'm kind of envisioning this earlier open air market, also telling you quantities kind of a situation.
We're also making somewhat of an assumption that it was used all at once,
mm-hmm.
but obviously this was built through time. This was an incredibly labor intensive effort here, right?
Mm-hmm.
'Cause like, where's the soil that was in these pits, right? Is mm-hmm. it built up around them? Was it carried away?
Well, they did make these walkways, so maybe it would help to construct that part of it.
But, but the walkways are much smaller than the soil represented in the holes, right?
Yeah,
so,
true. Yeah.
Like, where's all the soil? And maybe that's around there and it's just not being discussed in the article and it's obvious if you're out there, right?
Mm-hmm.
But either way, well, and it's on the top of a ridge. So if they were made in piles around it, it would have blown away long ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess the thing for me is, why did they keep building this, right? Because somebody had to dig the first hole. And then did they have an eye towards design or did somebody else come in and dig a second hole? Or were they like, we need to build a grid of 9x8 holes, you know, with this many, and this is what we're going to do. And this is what we're going to do for this purpose. Or was it more of an Easter Island type of thing? And it was like competition because there's definite sections between here, right? And did another community come over and say, oh, I see your pits and I raise your pits by this many or for certain reasons, territorial or whatever, I'm not going to use your pits. I need my own pits.
Sure. I mean, you know, all of that is definitely reasons why it could have happened.
So crazy.
There certainly had to have been somebody or some group of people who were directing the organization of it. Otherwise, you would just have people constructing pits all over the freaking place.
Yeah.
But these are organized. Now, they're in different quantities, and each section has different numbers of pits. The pits are roughly the same. There's some variation, but they're pretty similar in size. But the number of them clustered together could be different. And they all roughly stick to this kind of like long band that is about a mile long.
And that's the other thing. This band is almost like they took a transit or something and purposely made it a line.
Or they just followed a ridge.
But it's not even like if you look at picture B within the little picture structure, it actually comes off the ridge. Like it's on the ridge in the first part of the picture, the near part. And then off that, it just maintains the straight line and doesn't follow the ridge. It goes into the little drainages that are coming off the ridge. And then it makes a turn sort of following the contours of the ridge, but maintaining that separation from the top of the ridge where there's kind of a little road up there. And I'm just like, this is nuts. This is insanity. Like, why build this way? That little road probably wasn't up there. It could have been a path or something like that. But it's just like, why this orientation? Why?
Yeah.
If you were going to have some kind of a market, you'd think you'd want a big square or a circle or something that where everything's near each other.
I mean, it would be much more efficient.
Yeah. So, who's gonna go to pit number
like
one and
walk
be like
a mile away?
Be like, I want this half a ton of reeds over here, but I'm going to go to pit 5,000 also because they have some really great stuff too. Nobody's going to do that.
I know. It doesn't make sense when you look at it from that perspective. It's so hard to know why. Maybe they got decommissioned after a while. Maybe for some reason they weren't usable and then they would construct new ones the next season. And why they kept doing it in a line rather than repurposing the old ones, who knows? There could have been some kind of ritual involved. We don't know. All we can do is speculate. But one thing we do know is that the researchers have analyzed the pollen and plant remains that are found in the bottoms of these pits.
Mm-hmm.
And the plant remains found are maize. And then there's also materials linked to baskets, which are like the reeds and the rushes and various things like that. And like we said earlier, that indicates the goods were deliberately placed there, not naturally accumulated. They're not mixed together. There's one in one pit, one in another pit. So there was organization. They were putting these things in these pits for a specific reason, even if you don't want to believe it's to account for quantity, which... to me, seems like a nice, neat explanation.
Maybe for the Inca later on, but not early on. It doesn't make any sense. But
you could like compare it, right? Like you said, for competition, maybe it was competition. Like these different communities would be like, oh, how much corn you got, bro? And then they would like fill up their pits with all their maize that they had harvested. And like it could have been a competition.
But they were coming from so far away. Yeah. Like, why are they hauling all this stuff over to this area, right? It doesn't make any sense to me. I think... Well, okay, let's get on to that a little bit. Mm-hmm. First off, the science indicates that they were directly placed in the pits, right? We know that. We've talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
They found most of this through drone imagery, which revealed some numerical patterns in the pit arrangements. Okay, so we'll get to that in a minute.
Interesting.
But I do think, I mean, I hate to say it, but I have a feeling it's the only reason it seems like somebody would build something so monumental and keep going seems to be some sort of ritual significance.
And like it very well could have been
like maybe every year for whatever reason, they came back to this site. It could have been a small number of people, but a community, since you don't find this all over the place, kind of states to me that it's not a widely accepted practice or this got so big that you couldn't build something like this somewhere else. Like the Great Wall of China. There's only one of those because, you know, let's be honest. But also that the Great Wall of China also like joined up a bunch of walls, right? Yeah. It wasn't like built from start to finish, beginning to end.
Yeah.
But anyway, it seems to me like somebody did something and then somebody came back later on and did something right next to that, not wanting to use the original ones for some purpose. Could be sacred, could be whatever. And then continuing on, you see that with rock art all the time, you know, not wanting to, you know, you either deface rock art intentionally to take away the power of the people who created it, or you build somewhere else, you draw somewhere else in honor of that. Right.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
I feel like this is really difficult because it's a huge area, and the question that the archaeology is not answering is when it was used. Was it all used together in one giant band of pits? Was it partially here, you know, one year and then the next year was the next section? Or maybe it was split out around the year in different times. Mm-hmm. Like some pits were used specifically for one thing at one time of year, and then another time it was a different, you know? So like those kind of questions we're not able to answer given what remains they have at this point.
Yeah. So the one thing that we have talked about, we're kind of dancing around it, is the Incas.
Yeah.
And when the drones went over and they used AI and things like that to analyze the patterns and the numbers of holes and things like mm-hmm. that, certain patterns did start to emerge. And those patterns resemble quipus.
Yes.
And you may have seen quipus in pictures, something like that, but there's generally like a string at the top, a cord, and mm-hmm. then there's cords coming off of that of different lengths with different knots on them and different mm-hmm. clusters. And that is a well-known storytelling system used often for record accounting and record keeping, but also could be like storytelling and things like that, right? So
it could be,
quipus are incredible and they're fascinating. And
they are.
This almost seems like an earthen representation of a quipu when you start mm-hmm. looking at the numbers of the holes and how they're aligned. Because, you know, we kind of look at this from start to finish in the band, but maybe it should be read from side to side, mm-hmm. you know, something like that. And you look at a cluster of holes and then what's the number in each, you know, line in that cluster, and how does that work and how do you even count them?
Yeah, that one gets a little bit more ephemeral for me because I'm like, well, why didn't they just use a quipu, you know?
Well,
I guess to make it more visual
because quipus get destroyed.
Yeah,
and this could have been a preservable forever accounting of something.
Yeah,
you know, not necessarily goods and services.
Oh, like last year it was 25 pids.
Right.
You know, this year it's 36.
And what does that mean to those people?
Yeah. Right?
Who knows?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it could be seasonal. That's true. Maybe each cluster represents a year for whatever reason.
Sure.
That's an interesting idea. Cause like that you could look at, you know, there's ecological data that mm-hmm. would tell you how the seasons were potentially and what kind of growth they could have expected with their crops and stuff. So maybe that's something that they could have, that could inform the clusters and mm-hmm. why they are the numbers they are.
Yeah. Just let her go. I don't care.
So a little bit more about this area before we start talking about the Incas. The site lies in a transitional ecological zone called the Chapayangam. And this is, like I said earlier, right before coastal fishing areas and then also the highland farming regions, which is why they are saying this could have been a market where people came together to trade.
Yeah.
It was a natural meeting point. You know, people from the coast could have been bringing fish or salt or marine goods.
Yeah.
You know, from the farming areas, it could have been maize and other crops like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was huge. This area supported 100,000 people.
Yeah.
You know, so like you would need 5,000 pits if 100,000 people are coming together to trade, or the representatives of 100,000 people.
Yeah. I mean, that's like, what is 100,000 divided by 5,000? That's like 20 people per pit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because all of them showed up. Yeah. I don't know. There's a number of things this could have been. We'll ultimately never know what it was for, but it is fun doing the sort of analysis on it to maybe try to find numerical patterns and things like that mm-hmm. that we just can't see, you know, because there's too much.
Mm-hmm.
But also you got to kind of feed the AI models information about the Incas and things like that and quipus in the mm-hmm. past. So I don't know. I still think this being a single like open air market where everything was used all at once is a little far fetched. I do think that they built more pits either year after year or maybe a longer time frame than that and disused the older ones for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
I just can't see a reason why you build 5,000 of these. And mm-hmm. I also can't see a ridgetop like this supporting 100,000 people or even 10,000 people in one time on one weekend or 1 month for a market. Right?
No, that
just doesn't make any sense.
No, for sure. And the whole Inca thing makes so much more sense to me than the earlier stuff. The earlier thing, I'm not really sure exactly what they were going on, what they were doing there.
Yeah.
But the pits that date to Inca times, that makes sense to me because they had this labor tax system called the Mita. And basically, the Incas didn't have money. They mm-hmm. didn't like roll up and like take all the money from the people that they were conquering and bringing into their community. They had this tax system, labor tax system, where basically communities had to send laborers for like public works projects, like roads, temples, things like that. Or they could send people to do military service, or they could contribute goods and whatever kinds of goods they had. And then the Inca would then turn around and use the people for these projects, or they would take the goods and, you know, distribute them where necessary and also use them to build famine relief storehouses. Like the Incas were like pretty cool. I mean, they did mm-hmm. a lot of bloody stuff too. I don't think it was like great all the time.
Yeah.
But like once you were into the system, like, yeah, you had to like do some work, provide some goods or whatever, but like you got back from the Inca as well in the form of roads and temples and famine storehouses and things like that. So, but if the Incas roll up and they're like, all right, bro, like your contribution this year is X amount of corn. How do they measure that? That's
they transport the corn all the way to this whole system and put it in there so they can count it.
Or they tell all the communities to show up here at this one point because the Incas only want to go one place. They don't want to go to 25 different villages around the area. So they say, hey, you 25 villages, see you in April, or probably not April, like November or October or whatever, and bring all your corn. And then
there's a couple of people squatting in these holes. One's full of corn.
No, we're not talking about
the other one's full of chocolate bars.
This is not the people labor system. This is like the goods system that they're
sending laborers for public works. This is the laborer's hole.
Oh man, no, but yeah. Like it is, like you said, it would be a public way to keep track of what a community had contributed to the Incas. They could point at a group and say, "Hey, last year you did this many.
Yeah,
this year you only did this many. What's up?" You know, like, explain yourself.
Yeah, the article says that similar accounting practices are seen at the Inca site of Incahuasi, which used grids and cord records, but those cord records, like the quipu type of thing.
Yeah,
which is much more manageable. I really just don't buy any of the article's explanations for any of this. And, you know, sometimes you've just got to, I know Rachel's not on my side for this, but I'm going to say it anyway.
I'm not. I like this article. I think it makes sense.
Sometimes you've got to look at your own biases as well. And researchers are very aware of that these days. I'm not saying the guy who's the lead author on this didn't do this, but he's out of the University of Sydney, Australia. And his like whole deal is ancient accounting systems and counting and stuff like that. So my thought is somebody showed him a picture of this thing in Peru. And I don't know if he actually went out there and did the research. I didn't see that.
I don't know that he would need to. I mean, you're just crunching numbers, you know.
Well, who did all the drone research and the radiocarbon dating and all the other stuff? Like, true. I don't know if they did that or not. But either way, I feel like sometimes you have such a focus on your own research methodology that when you go look at something, you make it fit, right? You make it fit. I mean, some people, they see a nail. What do you think of? You think of a hammer, right? Because that's what you think of when you think of a nail. You see something like this and you're into ancient accounting systems, you think, oh, it must have been used for accounting. It must have been used for this because I've seen similar things.
Okay, but some of the greatest like reclassifications have happened because people saw something, didn't know what it was, and classified it incorrectly. And then somebody comes along with the right perspective, the right knowledge, and is like, oh no, it's this. You know? So like and that kind of research is really important because, you know, it's changing the way we classify a lot of things. I keep thinking of like Homo sapiens and early hominins and how those get reclassified all the time with new research. And so this is kind of a similar concept where he just had a different perspective. And this researcher's ideas fit what's going on here way better than any of the other ideas that have been proposed, like defense, like mining, fog capture. Like what what does that even mean?
I guess, like, water maybe, somehow. We're going to create a fog capture system on our property. Like I do want to capture fog and hold it.
I guess maybe. Mining, no. There's no way that they would. Defense, I mean, I guess maybe, but they have these specific plant remains in each pit. It just seems with that, it must have been for goods of some sort.
Yeah.
The why is still a little bit elusive, but I think that comparing different quantities of things in one place by different communities that are trading or contributing to the Incan Empire, perhaps, just makes sense because you have these consistent size pits. It makes it easy to measure. That just makes sense to me. You can keep disagreeing if you want, though.
I probably will.
Yeah. You're very disagreeable, so it makes sense.
Yes. So one thing that I didn't look in the original antiquity article and find, I'm kind of trying to search for it now, but I don't think, it doesn't sound like anyway, that they actually did radiocarbon dating on every single pit.
No, they found it at least one pit.
Out of 5,200.
1300s, which is pre-Inca.
Yeah.
And then I think the rest of them have later dates that they've dated, that they've been able to date. Because I'm not sure that they have plant remains that are dateable in every single pit either. So, yeah. So, like, if they, I would love to see, like, a map of which pits have plant remains in them. And then of those pits, which ones are dateable. Because that might give you a bigger picture of what's going on here, too. If all the plant pits are clustered on one section, like, what does that tell you? I don't know. I don't know what that tells you.
Yeah.
If they're spread out, then probably all the pits in between were used for the same thing. So
I personally think that in order to really understand what's going on here, we're going to need dates on every single pit, or at least every section. Right. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that will help sort of place this thing in some sort of a use period.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when were these things either we won't really know when they're constructed, but we may know when they were used.
Right? Yeah.
We could date some of the stuff inside of it.
Yeah.
One of them even had charcoal inside of it and they dated that. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Charcoal's, I mean, you're putting a fire in a pit, or are you doing that for ritual purposes, or are you burning something in the pit? Are you using these pits to prepare things? I think we have a lot of evidence of that from other areas, and I don't think that was conclusive here. So,
but like, yeah, they would all have charcoal remains in them if they were fire pits to do fire things.
I mean, how much analysis has been done on 5,200 pits? All we've done is count them at this point. You know, how much analysis has been done in every single pit?
This study is only talking about the counting.
Yeah.
So we would need to see other research on the pits themselves. What kind of excavation has been done? I'm sure not all 5,000 of them have been excavated, because that's the other thing is, like, you're not going to walk up to a pit and just see like the remains of a fire on the surface.
Yeah.
It's going to have, this is a desert. Like, this, the soil's been blowing around for years. So whatever is there, you're going to have to excavate it to find it.
Yeah.
And excavating 5,200 holes is probably not on anybody's, you know, bingo card right now. So yeah, some of them, but strategically, and that's, yeah, hopefully there's more research coming in that, because that might reveal exactly what these pits were used for.
Sounds like there's a couple of more PhDs that we could get out of this.
Yes.
So get your research going.
It feels like every site could have a couple more PhDs, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's enough for that. Again, yeah, let us know in comments wherever you found this, or on YouTube, or on just by emailing us. But we like the visual comments so they can be a more of a community discussion. So. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, come argue with us about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whose side are you on? Mine or Chris's?
Exactly. Exactly. Clearly mine. Okay.
No, I'm right, obviously.
All right, guys. Well, thanks a lot. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at arcpodnet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.arcpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.